traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie, one bad movie, for about 1 hour. This episode, we've only got one movie, but it's basically four and a half movies in one. It's Twilight Zone, the movie from 1983, directed by, in order, John Landis, Steven Spielberg, Joe Dante, and George Miller. And we'll be going through it in that order. So, you know, first of all, just to put this movie in its context, this was kind of a big deal. Spielberg alone, it would have been a big deal. But, like, Spielberg and Landis and then, you know, it's so odd. And it's such a product of its time, too, because it's got Joe Dante and George Miller. And I think what's remarkable about it is just from hindsight's point of view, this was the first time we've talked before about how Dante was kind of mentored by Spielberg, and it's really amazing. I mean, and this was, you know, the first gig that he gave him. It's just incredible that he would give him this gig based on he hadn't even done Gremlins yet. He gave him this gig based on The Howling and Piranha. That's pretty astounding. George Miller did, you know, The Road Warrior and Mad Max, so that's more understandable. But what's interesting about that is Spielberg was willing to collaborate with basically genre exploitation directors. I mean, George Miller was a long way off from, you know, Happy Feet here. It's Spielberg collaborating, you know, choosing, giving this great opportunity to a Corman protege and an Aussie, you know, biker exploitation movie director, along with Landis, who, you know, who we should get into here. But it's just conceptually, like, it couldn't be more of a product of its time. And I guess it really shows how different, you know, the mainstream was at the time, that, you know, it's basically like Spielberg in the mainstream there, you know, extending a hand to a little further down the ladder, which is just something he didn't do afterwards. But yeah, it's quite conceptually interesting that they chose that it was made with the people that it was made with. Okay, so all that aside, Landis did the prologue and the first segment. And the first segment is infamous because there was a helicopter accident that killed the lead actor, Vic Morrow, and two children who shouldn't have even been working there because of their age, two child extras. But before we get into that, you know, the opening prologue. Remember when we were talking about American Werewolf in London? I was trying to make the case that Landis was an influence on Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
I don't think I remembered to include the opening prologue of Twilight Zone, the movie, but that's probably the best evidence for that case, because it's Albert Brooks and Dan Aykroyd talking about old TV shows and old TV theme songs. They're playing a game, driving in the car. And, you know, that's characters talking about pop culture, and Landis uses it as an opportunity for them to start talking about the Twilight Zone. And that's a very postmodern way to open Twilight Zone, the movie. Apparently I read that we both read a pretty extensive article on twilightzonemuseum.com about the making of this movie. It had a ton of stuff that I never knew about, and it helped explain a lot. But one of the pieces of information in it was that Landis, I guess, wanted to do this prologue. This was an idea for a short film that he had, and he used this as an opportunity to incorporate it into Twilight Zone, the movie. So, you know, even as a kid, I saw this movie a lot as a kid. It was on TV a lot. And, oh my God, does it play better on TV with commercial breaks? Because then it is more like watching a few episodes of the TV show than having to watch all this stuff that doesn't link thematically at all in the movie. But even as a kid, I knew that as memorable as Dan Aykroyd suddenly having a monster face is, as surprising as it is the first time, it's not in the style of Twilight Zone at all. Twilight Zone would surprise you, but it never surprised you arbitrarily. Things just didn't happen for no reason. It was all, there had to be an ironic reason, even if it was a really flimsy ironic reason, you know, like Landis comes up with in his segment. Even if it was a really flimsy ironic reason, there still had to be a reason. So it, now knowing what's coming and not having, and there not being any suspense around, you know, where's this conversation about them talking about old Twilight Zone episodes going, now it just bugs me more than ever. that opening.
No.
Although the conversation between Brooks and Aykroyd does sound natural, and they do a fine job of it, whatever.
No, see, I didn't like Brooks in this. I thought it was forced.
Okay. Well,
I thought he was,
sure.
And I kept wondering. So Dan Aykroyd's like a hitchhiker, or no?
It's not really clear.
It's unclear,
but this time around,
yeah.
I always assumed they were two friends, but I think when the radio goes out and he says, you know, I guess we got to talk. Well, we already did that. Yeah, I know where you're from. I guess that's supposed to imply that Aykroyd's a hitchhiker.
Yeah. So, and it just,
which would help explain why this guy who, you know, if they were friends, why didn't he know that he was a demon monster?
a pinkish blue face demon monster.
Looks like an old lady monster.
Yeah, it's really not clear why he even does it. And then he kills him, which is sort of, but anyway, it's not like he just shows him the scary face and that's it. But and then it kicks off the opening credits, which, well, it's not really opening credits, it's just the title sequence. And then the Jerry Goldsmith music comes up, too, before you go into the traditional Twilight Zone theme. And Jerry Goldsmith never worked with Spielberg, I don't think, except on this.
No, because he did the Gremlins music.
Right.
Which
was
produced by Spielberg.
But it was produced, and he did a bunch of music in movies produced by Spielberg. But, yeah, I'm like, is this,
but not for him as a director.
Right. I'm like, is this John Williams? I mean, it sounds like E.T. light. And that's what this movie kind of feels like. It feels like a very, it's not an Amblin movie, but it very much feels like it during the first two segments. Even the Landis one. I mean, the Spielberg one is, you know, I'll get to it then, but it's very Amblin. And then the music, it's not bad during the rest of it, but during the first two segments, it's just kind of, I was kind of dreading it because you had said that the first two are bad, the second two are good. And I'm like, okay. So I had to get through the first two. And then I really didn't know what to expect from the Landis short. So,
you know what? I thought it was okay when I was a kid, but even if he hadn't murdered anyone, it would still be the worst thing he's ever done.
It's so incredibly trite. So it's, you have this somewhat shocking scene.
And again, even as a kid, I knew that it wasn't doing justice to the Twilight Zone style, that it was a misunderstanding of it.
Yeah. I mean that too, that it just does not work with. Yeah.
Even the simplest Twilight Zones were never that thick-headed.
When Rod Serling wanted a movie made of the Twilight Zone, I don't think he ever imagined anything like this. What it is Vic Morrow's he's a racist. And so there's this really...
He's a vocal racist.
He's a vocal racist. I mean,
he's the kind of racist who uses the N-word when they're sitting right next to him.
Yeah. So it's like, it's this really weird sequence. And I like how they cut out the fact that his friends were originally racist too.
Yeah. apparently, in the original script.
And then he goes off.
So you just got these two guys who just tolerate their scenery chewing racist friend.
And then he leaves the bar because he's so upset, and he winds up in Nazi Germany. And I was like, so why is he in Nazi Germany? Because I had no idea what this was about.
Because he's a racist.
And I'm like, okay, so he's in Nazi Germany.
Isn't that clever?
And I'm like, what's he learning from this experience? And I didn't understand that he was supposed to be Jewish. I just thought he was magically transferred. I mean, at the beginning of it, I'm like, you know, okay, so he's in
That never occurred to me. I mean, the Nazis do slap a Star of David on him, but I think they.
He's Jewish in Nazi Germany, just like he's black in the South.
I meant self-hating for a second.
No. And it's like, so he's upset. And I'm like, did the Nazis take over? It's not clear that he's in the past originally. I'm like, did they take over? Because, you know. And then, so apparently the lessons he learns are by living in other people's shoes that it's unpleasant to be Jewish in Nazi Germany, black in the South, and Viet Cong. But it's so stupid.
Well, it's so stupid because, I mean, what else is there to discuss? It's like it's not even a one sentence. It's not even a one sentence concept. It's like half a sentence. I just, it's so mean spirited and it's got this air of superiority about it. Like you're supposed to be enjoying, you know, that this racist is going through all this stuff. And like, you know, just to cut to the chase here, cause we're about to have to talk about the accident. the segment ends with him stuck in time, and he doesn't seem like that bad a guy that he deserves that fate. It seems out of proportion. It seems like, you know, if that was going to happen to him, then we should have seen him kill a man or something because of his racism. But, you know, instead it's like, you know, the omnipotent John Landis's idea of the Twilight Zone is a place where you get sentenced to death for making racist remarks in a bar to your buddies. And apparently that's how it originally ended, and it was the studio's insistence that he make a new ending where he gets redeemed by rescuing a couple of Viet Cong kids. And so they had actually already shot the ending where he is redeemed and sent back to the present, but they didn't want to do it because in the accident that killed Morrow and the two kids, it was because of the two kids. They didn't want to use footage with the kids in it. They thought that would be, you know, pushing it. So
keeping his segment in the first place wasn't pushing it. Oh no.
Well, that was what I couldn't even believe that. I always assumed that all these segments were filming simultaneously or something, but Landis's segment was the very first thing that they filmed. Like before Spielberg or Miller or Dante got started, Landis's was the very first thing, and they decided to press on. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, Spielberg wanted to quit, and he changed the story he was going to do. He was really upset about it. He credits Twilight Zone as changing his outlook on filmmaking and all that crap. But yeah, I mean, they kept it in, and it's just kind of like, well, okay, so what happened was, they illegally hired these kids because when they tried to legally hire kids, they were told, you can't have a kid working at 2:30 in the morning on this kind of set. You just can't do it. And so they're like, okay. And so the producer, who I think has worked with Landis on all of his movies, like got his dentist's kid and then was like, hey, do you know any other Asian people? And his dentist found somebody else. And so, you know, it's like the parents of these two kids were like, oh, it'd just be so cool. They're going to be in a movie. I mean, this will be great for them to look back on when they're grown up. You know, it was just a cool little thing they were going to do. And then you read the story about how, like, they're there. It's terribly dangerous. They're the production crew is lying to the fire department. And the parents are concerned, and they're lying to the parents about it. And they're telling the parents not to say that they're visiting and stuff like that. And that they're not actually working on the movie, because that'd be against the law. And so then there's like a freak accident with the helicopter, and it impales one of the kids on one of the whatever you call the thing that comes down off the bottom of the helicopter.
Blade.
Well, no, it decapitated Vic Morrow and the other one. Yeah. And then of course,
but the other kid was impaled on another part of it. Okay.
So they died instantly. So I guess that's cool. And then apparently Landis's response was, okay, everybody, that's a wrap. Head on home.
Yeah. And you didn't see Steve. Oh, Andrew, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. It sounded like you cut out. Yeah, and, you know, I made this joke when we were talking about American Werewolf in London, that if you look at the trajectory of Landis's career, you can kind of see the Twilight Zone coming, because he insists on having spectacular action sequences, and not even action sequences so much as just like destruction, and it's often very incidental destruction. Like at the end of American Werewolf in London, there's this like massive car pile up in Piccadilly Circus, and like bodies are being thrown from windows and stuff, and it's all like non-werewolf violence that's just there. So, and you know, Blues Brothers is a comedy. Does it need to end with, you know, a million car? He loves the vehicular destruction. So, you can almost see Twilight Zone coming. And, you know, I mean, just to freely theorize in a way that's not flattering to Landis, I think maybe the reason that the Twilight Zone accident happened is because, number one, he comes from a low budget he came from a low budget background and was used to cheating the rules of film production. And so as he was given larger budgets, he was taking similar risks with bigger toys, let's say. And number two is I don't think a director who can primarily considers themselves a comedy director, or whose background is primarily comedy, is the best judge of stunts. Like, I think the reason no one was ever fatally wounded on a Hal Needham movie is that, while Hal Needham may not have been the best director, he definitely knew how cars worked. Whereas Landis is just, you know, a kid with his train set and like, yeah, let's just have the helicopter go lower because that would look better. And a big part of the trial was trying to figure out exactly, how low Landis was yelling for the fatal helicopter to go. And if you knew a little bit more about helicopters, well, maybe he wouldn't have asked for it to go lower, and nothing would have happened, and it would have been fine. But that's my theory, anyways. I mean, actually, watching this movie and thinking about this stuff again makes me want to read a book that was put out shortly after the trial concluded, called "Reckless Conduct, Outrageous Conduct."
Yeah, and I mean,
It's got a helicopter on the dust jacket. Made me want to read it. But I'm just kind of freeform theorizing based on what I can tell from Landis's movies.
Yeah, I think, and that's kind of the thing that I never really understood, that he was a megalomaniac, until I read like the trial transcripts and stuff like that. That he's just, you know, he demanded he be allowed to speak at Vic Morrow's funeral about how.
Wow, I knew it. I knew he was there. I didn't know he demanded to speak.
Yes, he and the producer who hired the kids demanded to be heard, and they said that this film, you know, they're pushing ahead because it's what Vic would have wanted, and all this, and you know, every review.
meanwhile, it's not even in memory of him, and he doesn't even get to live at the end of his segment. He gets carted off to Auschwitz.
And I mean, so. Even when the movie came out in 83, people were making cracks that this is not something that Vic Morrow, it was worth Vic Morrow dying for, let me just say it. Like, I think Ebert says that. I think the New York Times said that. You know, it's just like, no.
And Vic Morrow was like a B-movie actor. I mean, like, you know, whatever Italian Mad Max knockoff he was in just before this would have been a better tribute to his memory.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another questionable thing about the Landis one is, why Vic Morrow? It would have been a lot better with a good actor. I mean, Jack Lemmon. If you'd had Jack Lemmon in that role, it would have been stunning.
Someone you wouldn't expect to hear talking about kikes.
Right.
Would have been more interesting.
Exactly. Or, you know, I mean, yeah. It would have just been crazy. Yeah. But instead, no, it's somebody you don't care about, and it's just... Yeah.
Well. Well, we do. I mean, we kind of have to divide up our time.
Yeah.
With
so
these segments. But
let's segue.
Is there anything else pertinent about Landis and his segments or the trial?
Well, you notice about how his daughter's got a payoff from Spielberg?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. The one daughter and then Jennifer Jason Leigh, they settled out of court when they sued Spielberg and their other producers. And that's kind of the thing everybody was suing Spielberg for this because his name was on it too. And, you know, he was such a sweetheart, you know, he just made E.T. for God's sake. So my sort of glib thing was first, you know, I wonder how much money they got, right? Like, cause I'm just curious, you know, does Jennifer Jason Leigh have to work? Like, like at all, like ever, like, or could she just, you know, sit on a hovercraft or something? And then my second thing was, has she ever made a movie with Spielberg?
I'm going to guess.
I don't think she has.
No. Yeah.
So then,
or Landis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is that Landis, I don't understand. I understand some regard of respect for him, but I don't understand the people who are like, well, Spies Like Us is the greatest movie ever made and stuff like that. I was like,
well, of course he was robbed doing similarly spectacular.
Exactly. You know, all of Hollywood was. They had to cut out the, you know, helicopter stunts. But, you know, but just hearing what a loon the guy is, of, you know, he's an artist. I mean, that was like a whole lot of questioning was they were like, you know, trying to figure out how his artistry, if he had any responsibility for it. And it's just, you know, it's John Landis. The guy made, you know, what, Trading Places. That's not high art.
He's killed more people than Cecil B. DeMille, to paraphrase Blazing Saddles.
Okay, so, and then, of course, this is perfect segue to Spielberg, because he's next up.
Yeah, and something that I learned from that TwilightZoneMuseum.com article is that he had an original story about a kid who goes trick-or-treating, and he's a bastard, and then Halloween starts to become real, basically. And they ditched that because apparently, I mean, people pointed this out at the time too. People were like, you know, the first segment is, you know, overlooking the helicopter. The first segment is really dark. The other two segments are pretty dark also. Why is Spielberg's so light? Why did he choose to remake Kick the Can and then make it even more treacly and syrupy and get Scatman Crothers to play a magic Negro? Like, why did he do this segment that sticks out like a sore thumb just in terms of tone from the other ones? And, yeah, he thought people needed an uplift, so he chose to direct Kick the Can, which was kind of a sappy episode of the original series. I mean, to be fair, like, probably the sappiest episode. There were some really sappy original Twilight Zones, and the sappiest ones actually tended to be written by Rod Serling himself, but Spielberg takes Kick the Can and he actually makes it even more sappy and treacly by like adding Scatman Crothers as a magic Negro and shooting everything through a soft gauze. And it's so sappy. It's like Spielberg is practically doing a parody of him, of his own sappiness. And like it sticks out like a sore thumb from the rest of the movie. But I mean, and the transition from from Landis's segment is pretty jarring, but I remember it used to be even more jarring when it was on TV, because like the last shot of the Vic Morrow is like this long crane shot up past the train and into the night. And then a few sec, you know, there's some darkness, and then it starts to fade into Spielberg's segment. But on TV, like, they thought that darkness went on for too long, and they just did this really hard cut from like the last you see of the train car to the sunny sky over the retirement home, and that was even more jarring. But at least then it seemed, you know, that was like putting a point on the jarringness instead of trying to gloss over it with a long fade. Anyways, it's just unbearably treacly, and anybody who hates Steven Spielberg, this is like pornography for the Spielberg hater, because it's everything that's annoying about him. It's his fetishization of old people as cute. It's his fetishization of childhood as a time of magical innocence and wonder, and well, I don't know. It's got a magic Negro, and it just goes for the heartstrings. What can I say? It's unbearable.
Now, what I found interesting about it,
it's even got a nod to Peter Pan. That's one more thing.
Which, you know, of course, is a nod to Hook. And then the whole damn movie is basically, did he executive produce Cocoon? Because it's like, watching this, no, he didn't. But he did do Batteries Not Included, which is about old people feeling young again. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, this is just Spielberg's thing. Like, watching this, it's hard to believe that he didn't produce Cocoon. But no, I think this is, as far as I can tell, the first time he had a Jewish character in one of his movies. He made a big deal about the character being Jewish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. For no reason. I mean, it's just there. It's an incidental detail. But yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Because I was thinking about it. I was looking at it. And I'm like, yeah, I think this is the first time he did. Because he actually doesn't do it a lot, in a way. And it actually sticks out like a sore thumb in the Spielberg thing. But as much as you can. I did like that Selma Diamond from Night Court was in it. I thought she was good. She was funny enough. And John Larroquette. Yeah. She's the smoking
the
old
cat.
Lady.
Okay.
And then John Larroquette was actually in the first segment. So it's like a Night Court
reunion. Yeah.
Or I think it's just pre-Night Court. Who knows? Yeah, and then Scatman Crothers is in it, sort of like, hey, it's Scatman Crothers, just like in The Shining. Yeah.
As Crispin Glover pointed out, our lionization of Spielberg says a lot about our culture. And how sick is it? You know how baby boomers don't want to die? How sick is it that how old was Spielberg when he was making this thing in 1983? He's like in the prime of his adulthood, and he's making a movie about old people wanting to be young again. And he's like projecting his, you know, near middle aged insecurity about aging onto people who are actually old, you know, not old enough to be realistically put in a nursing home, but, you know, old for the movies, basically. It's kind of sick. It's kind of the scene where the guy is dropping off his dad at the old folks home at the beginning of the segment. I hate that, because it's like it's like Spielberg dealing with the guilt of baby boomers putting their parents away in rest homes. Disrespectful brats. It's like a big, and then on top of all that, on top of just all the stuff about how sick it is to ponderously go over the magic of being young, how sick is it that like he only did this, like this was his idea of, you know, just something to make people feel good because they would be thinking about Vic Morrow's severed head after the end of the last segment and two dead kids. It's like, look, here are some alive children. Look, the old people turned into living, breathing children. You know, it's almost like making up for what happened. So it's reactionary. So it's reactionary on top of all else.
Well, let's not forget though that there's a kid who run one of. So basically, the old people turn into kids, then realize they don't want to be kids, so they grow up again or they turn old again. Except one of them, because he wants to go get laid, but he's like 9. So it's really kind of creepy that he's like so into sex.
And 9. And he leaves. And he leaves out the window wearing a cape and no shirt.
Yeah, so, that kid's got a great future. Let me tell you.
Yeah, he's gonna go hustle on the nearest
exactly
street
exactly. Where's that sequel?
And he's English, so you know we can only assume that he's bi already because he was brought up in a boarding school.
And I don't think he was English when he was old. I think he was just full of shit. But yeah, so he runs off.
He's putting on that accent, sure. Just wanted to be the most interesting guy at the rest home.
So yeah, I mean, it's just, it's awful. I mean, in a way, it's kind of better than the first one because it seems shorter. And there is like a, wow, this is really freaking stupid aspect to it. Like nothing good ever happens in it, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, but it ends with them running out and all the old people deciding they're not going to, you know, be cooped up. They're going to run out and have fun. And I'm like, this is Cocoon. This is Cocoon. There you go.
It did precede Cocoon, but you know, it's the Fountain of Youth story. It goes back a long time. You know what else I noticed as a kid about this movie that I still notice and it still bugs me? When at the end of this segment, Scatman Crothers is walking down the street and singing. And it's supposed to end there, but then you've got like one more shot of him walking to the next rest home and entering.
In this town of rest homes. Let's not forget
that. There's another rest home around the block, of course. So, I don't think anything else really needs to be said about it. It's bad.
Yeah. And then we start getting to the good stuff. So.
And then stuff starts getting better. Although, to be totally sober in the assessment of this, when you're watching it all as one movie, it's really fucking hard to enjoy the second half, because even though it's better, you've just sat through so much bullshit that you feel like the movie really owes you at that point, and it pays you back a little bit for sitting through the first half, but nothing can really, they don't have enough time to pay you back for sitting through all that crap.
No.
But, you know, and also to be honest, perfectly honest, neither Dante nor Miller's segments are as good as I remembered them, but hey, they're still good. And it's prime era Dante and Miller. And, you know, the Dante segment, you hadn't seen it before, right?
Actually, as I was watching it, I realized that I've seen at least the Dante segment and possibly the Miller segment. I just had never seen the first two.
Oh, okay.
So I just saw them on TV, you know, at some point.
Yeah, I thought maybe, heck, this played on TV a whole lot. And it's it's unmistakably Dante crafting his trademarks, like the Dick Miller cameo, the use of Kevin McCarthy, the fixation on cartoons as a theme. You know, quite overtly in this case, probably as overtly as he would ever do before, I don't know, Looney Tunes back in action. It's a thing about cartoons and TV. But it's prime era Dante, so even though the ending wimps out, apparently the ending only wimps out because it was going to end the movie and they were going to have the main character run into Dan Aykroyd to bookend the whole thing, but instead they have to create kind of a ambiguous, basically redemptive for the little kid who is a little monster and doesn't freaking deserve redemption.
True.
But aside from the misstep of the ending, I think it's pretty successful.
Yeah, and I mean, the ending is a misstep, but it's not as bad as it could have been. Like,
true. Yeah.
You know, the alternative would have been, I think the problem with the alternative would have been that you have your Kathleen Quinlan goes through this trial and is spared by the kid who still would have learned his a lesson and let her go, only to get killed by the machinations of a, you know, anthology theme movie.
A lot of kids in this movie.
Yeah, and there's just
Spielberg.
And there's even a kid in the next segment. There's a kid in all of it except the first one.
That's what I'm just realizing.
John Landis killed the kids in his segment. And now
he's edgy.
Dante and Miller. Well, Miller wasn't interviewed for this thing we read, but Dante basically said that he and Miller were pretty cut off from anything else that was going on, and they just got to do whatever they wanted. And Dante later said that it sort of spoiled him for making movies in the studio system, because he thought that this is just how they did it. They just left you alone. He didn't realize it was because, you know, they were getting their asses sued for killing people.
Because nobody wanted their name. No executive wanted their name on this thing.
So, yeah, and I mean, it opens. I guess there's a Bill Mummy cameo at the beginning.
I think it's Mummy, but yeah, he's one of the guys in the bar at the beginning. So and of course, he was the kid in the original episode.
Yeah, it's got this nice little opening, and Dick Miller just.
Dick Miller.
In some ways, it's like this segment of The Twilight Zone could have been. You know, a sitcom with Dick Miller is, you know, this gross diner owner who hits on all the women while his wife is checking up on him. Yeah, there's that's gold right there. And then if you'd had, you know, the girl and the little kid driving around the country solving people's problems, that's Starman the series. Like, that's the Sixth Sense right there, like.
Yeah.
The other thing is that we haven't mentioned is the Twilight Zone movie was originally intended to spawn sequels that would just be Spielberg-picked directors. Anthology sequels every year or two. And it bombed. And which killed that, kind of like how Halloween 3 was supposed to kick off the whole new, the whole new thing there. But yeah, so they end up at the house, and the house, once you get to the house, it's a lot of fun now just because of the Simpsons.
But yeah, the fact that one of the hostages is Nancy Cartwright, who would later voice Bart Simpson.
But it's still fun because
there's the irony of life imitating art and being trapped in cartoons and all that.
But the dad is William Shallert, who was the dad in the Patty Duke show. And I mean,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was in Inner Space too, and he was in I think he's been in some others, at least one other Dante thing. But no, he's the dad on the Patty Duke show. And it's like Dante just really knows how to do that kind of thing. I mean, like, What's-His-Face had to force it. Landis had to force it at the beginning with the TV themes. I mean, it's kind of okay, but yeah, it's a Tarantino scene. It's funny because it's guys making, you know, doing TV themes, how they remember them with, you know, noises. It's funny, but it's not like Dante who's casting these people who it just works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know we're both huge Dante fans, and we both, you've probably noticed, you know, the TV is a recurring theme in most of his movies, and this is just like probably the most overt example of that. But yeah, casting, very clever casting around that. And Kevin McCarthy, you know, wasn't identified. He's more identifiable like as a B movie figure, but you know, he definitely fits the kind of, basically, like, you know, Anthony's family is sort of like a living TV sitcom family. And you know, actually there's kind of another layer of irony in the the way that they mention that, like, you know, oh, he's been through other people before. He just brings them here and makes them pretend to be his mom or his dad or his sister. And when
right.
one of them steps out of line, he just gets someone else to replace him, which raises the question of, like, if Kathleen Quinlan was replacing anybody or if she was going to. But there's kind of an added layer in the fact that, well, they're a TV sitcom family and, you know, sitcom casts do get replaced occasionally sometimes. A character has to be played by a new person or something. It's the Dick York, Dick Sargent thing. Oh, the script we should mention, like, Richard Matheson, who, you know, is a legendary horror writer and was also a screenwriter on original Twilight Zone episodes, has the single credit for writing on Miller and Dante's segments. And he did have he has co-writing with two other people on the Spielberg segment, which is kind of hard to believe it took three people to write Spielberg segment. But yeah, Landis is just Landis. But by the time you get to Dante's segment, it's the writing is suddenly a whole lot better. And that's because it's suddenly Richard Matheson.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that too. Oh,
he didn't write the original story of It's a Good Life, but he did write the original Nightmare at 20,000 Feet story that was the basis of the original episode. So this is him like returning to his own work for the Miller segment. But yeah, the Dante segment, it basically, you know, it's about Dante's love of cartoons and TV, but I think, you know, I think the original short story was written in the early 50s, and when they made the episode, it was the early 60s. And I think part of the satire of the original story is, you know, which wasn't about television; it was just about a kid with the powers, but there wasn't the TV theme around it. I think part of the satirical intent of the original story was, you know, youth as the new demographic controller of culture, and like because of television and because of mass media, like the preferences of the culture are now going to be, you know, subject to the whims of children, and suddenly, like, you know, children are going to have more power than adults. They're going to have more representation anyway than adults will because of the media. So I think the original story has an unspoken element of media satire in it that Dante consciously or unconsciously kind of picked up and extrapolated. And that's why, as like different as his version of the story is, I think it perfectly complements it with the new dimension of, you know, cartoons and television. Like, you know, yeah, because of course if a kid had superpowers, if he could bend reality, he'd make it more like a cartoon. Kids love cartoons.
Yeah, that was the one, the scene. The kid at one point says, you know, I've given these people all they want and this is how they treat me. I'm like, yeah, but you're making them sit around and watch cartoons all day. I'm like,
yeah.
In a way.
I love the editing, the sound mixing and stuff of the cartoon clips in the background correlating to what's happening in the scenes.
Yeah.
That's a really great touch. And it's not something that you see done much, and it's pretty clever the way they do it. And it's only been done a couple other places, probably, that I can't even name right now. But I always love that detail.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so well produced, too, after the rest. It's just, it's beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it's like, it's Dante working with, like, his regular producer, Mike Finnell, I think is his name. And, you know, he's like he's working with Rob Bottin on the special effects again. And I don't know who his DP is, but I think is it John Hora?
Yeah.
John Hora has been Dante's DP on other stuff. So obviously they worked really well together. It's just, yeah, prime era Dante. I keep saying that, but it's sort of, you know, my favorite era of Joe Dante, the early, you know, Piranha to Gremlins. It's right up there with like The Howling and stuff.
You know, before Spielberg had too much of a negative influence on,
before he told him that Gizmo had to live and not turn into a gremlin.
Or, you know, before what the Soldiers movie, Small Soldiers, when he brought him back for that. And now, yeah, I mean, it's just, and that was what was surprising to me, is because I didn't, the last time I would have seen this, I didn't know that this was Dante's segment. And I was surprised that he did the one with Kathleen Quinlan, because I remember when Apollo 13 came out, she had the role, the very high profile role as Tom Hanks's wife. I mean, she basically had the entire Earthbound story thing, and they were like, yeah, she was really big in the, she almost made it back in the 80s in this kind of thing because of Spielberg and that. And it's not even Spielberg directing her sequence, but I guess he, you know, remembered her just as the executive producer or something.
Yeah, she's pretty charming in this.
Yeah, I mean, she really...
It's a pretty thankless role.
But she is able to sell the idea that she gets away with this with the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, a big...
That she can actually... That, yeah, yeah, like, as much as I don't like the happy ending, as forced as it is, she does kind of sell the idea that she has some pity and some compassion for him. Mainly because of that line about, you know, they'll try to send me away like my real parents or something.
Yeah.
So that's part of his rationale for holding everyone hostage. You know, if I would criticize one thing about it, I'd say that, you know, the Rob Bottin stuff, even though it looks cool, it doesn't really seem functional. Like when Kevin McCarthy pulls the monster rabbit out of his hat, it can't really do anything except hover there over him. But even though, like, I love the way that cartoon, you know, gremlin, for lack of a better term, that comes out of the TV. I love the way it looks, even if it doesn't look convincing, even if it doesn't really seem like it's a real thing in the room there with them.
My thing about that was, it's obviously supposed to be Wile E. Coyote. It's a Warner movie.
It kind of spins like the Tasmanian Devil when it comes out of the TV.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a mix of the two. Like, how did they not get it the permission? You would have thought Warner would have just been all over that. But maybe by this time, no, they weren't all over there.
Well, you know what's... Well, I mean, you know, the sorry state of animation was at a pretty low point in 1983. I didn't... like when the sister Nancy Cartwright gets wished into Cartoon Land by
Anthony.
Oh
yeah.
That animation is done by what's her name? Sally Cruikshank, who did the animation for like a ton of 80s movies, it seemed. Like Mannequin probably is one you would know. The opening animated site. She's just got a pretty distinctive
okay.
look. So, like, when you see her stuff, you can recognize it. And she did the opening titles for Mannequin and maybe, like, a few other movies. Yeah, and they got her to do, you know, it's just kind of speaks to the sorry state of the industry that they had to go to basically an independent artist to do some, you know, full animation somewhat in the style of a 1930s Fleischer cartoon. And I love the way that they foreshadow it with the Fleischer cartoon that the sister with no mouth is watching for what happens
yeah.
to Ethel later. But yeah, they had to go, like, they couldn't even get someone at Warner Brothers to do that. But, you know, whatever, they do use the Looney Tunes clips on the TV. But it is interesting that they don't do anything recognizable. Probably the most recognizable clip that they show is, like, Heckle and Jekyll, which wasn't originally Warner Brothers, but... In any case, yeah, it's, you know, the wish the being wished into Cartoon Land thing is an effective sequence, I think, because with the music and everything, they really do sell it like it's this horrible thing, this horrible fate to be eaten by a cartoon dragon after being wished into a TV set. And that's kind of like the one nasty thing that you get to see Anthony do besides the sister with no mouth.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it's... I think that
in a way it's, yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I think that I'm easier on the ending just because it was such a breath of fresh air after the first two, just in terms of competency of writing alone, like,
right. Yeah, no, I agree. And, I think it's kind of, I think with Dante, it's kind of the stepping stone as far as like the relative nastiness of Piranha and the Howling against the sweetness combined with nastiness and Gremlins. This is kind of a combination of sweet and nasty, and the sweetness is Spielberg's doing, of course. Although, again, to be fair, they weren't going to end it with Redemption originally. They were going to end it with Kathleen Quinlan hitching a ride with Dan Aykroyd and her presumed death, which would have been pretty dark. But in any case, originally this was going to end the movie, and before it was going to be Miller's segment. And they even shot a link between the two of them that they couldn't then use. But Miller's segment to Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. again, wasn't as good as I remembered it. But I think my chief complaint about it now is that there's no build up or anything. It starts at this really excited, frantic pace where John Lithgow is going crazy, and he just stays crazy. He doesn't even get noticeably crazier after spotting the gremlin. He seems to be kind of in the same place of craziness through the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I was just trying to place this in his career. It sort of is one of those defining roles for him. But I think, and he had done some De Palma at this point, but I still think he would have been most popular as, wasn't he in World According to Garp? Like, he was a friendly guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, in Blowout the year before, if you'd seen it, you would have seen him being a brutal psychotic murderer or whatever. But, yeah, no, it's just, he's so crazy to the point you can't even really laugh at his interaction with the kid as much as you should, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, he has this scene with the Christina Nigra from, God, Everything. Like, why is she so familiar? She might not be for you, but she was in Cloak and Dagger, which I would have seen as a kid, and she's really annoying in that, so I remembered her from that. And then I guess she was the sidekick on Out of This World, so.
Well, she's supposed to be an annoying little girl in this one.
Yeah, and she's very annoying, and yeah. What I think's most striking about it is how well directed it is, even though it's in like a lot of this, the segment just takes place in his row. And just his seat.
Yeah, not even like the. You don't ever really see the whole plane.
Yeah.
It pretty much is just in his row.
So, I mean, he does a good job. Miller does a really good job with that in something that you don't even expect from him, considering that he just did the Road Warrior. Road Warrior didn't have any sequences like that.
Mm-hmm. Nothing in so confined a space. The opposite, actually. Yeah. You know, Jerry Goldsmith's score in this, he uses strings to signify the presence of the gremlin, and he does this kind of fiddling, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do kind of stuff on the violin that he then reuses in Gremlins 1 year later. I always thought that was noteworthy. And the, you know, I don't know if you read the Matheson story, but it gets inside the guy's head, obviously. But to compare it to the TV show for a moment, in the TV show, Shatner is he's with his fiance or something. So he's actually got someone to to tell what he's feeling while still trying to not sound crazy. And the movie version really tries to put you in the main character's shoes a lot more, because he doesn't have anyone to talk to, and everyone around him, no one around him is really incredulous. There's never a scene where they're like, a gremlin, what? It's just that, you know, he was already freaking out. they were already concerned about him, and now he's like really giving them reason for concern. But here again, I think, you know, watching this movie on TV helped more, because there was just, I don't know, his decision to break the glass and fire a gun at the creature does happen in the short story, but it doesn't, it seems to happen more gradually in the story than it does in the movie. It kind of seems to come out of nowhere in the movie, and that's why a commercial break helps a little bit. Like, if about halfway through you have to sit through some commercials and think about what John Lithgow is going through, then you're maybe a little more credulous when he decides to let himself get sucked out into the screaming vacuum of space almost. But you certainly can't fault the segment from a technical standpoint. And conceptually, you know, it's Matheson getting to redo his own story. And, you know, I think the only mistake he makes is Lithgow's crazy, a little too crazy from the beginning. It would have been better to see that build up. But, you know, it's good. What can I say? it's almost too competent to comment on, because it's nothing, because it's not exactly special, but it is well done.
Yeah. The pilot that shows up, that was good. He did a good job with his interacting with Lithgow. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was.
Oh, I know something. Okay. I wanted to mention. probably the only real George Miller trademark that you could spot in this is the use of a dummy head of your lead actor with eyes bugging out, which it's not the lead actor, but you see that in Mad Max when the toe cutter gets hit by a truck. There's this split second shot of eyeballs bulging out of a skull, and it's not the actor. It's a dummy head. Excuse me, that they made for that effect. And it's even more subtle in Twilight Zone, the movie, but it's also even more pronounced. And I remember, I think, watching this on video back in the day and freeze framing those eyeballs bugging out. And when you actually freeze frame the shot of the eyeballs bugging out, it's when Lithgow opens the window and sees the creature staring at him, like right there. It's pretty ridiculous looking, actually. It almost looks like they did it with animation. It's so exaggerated. But the funny thing is that that's like actually a nice confluence of Miller's trick from Mad Max with, there actually is a passage in the short story where the guy looks out the window, the creature is right there up against the glass, and Matheson describes it as like, you know, the guy feels like his eyeballs are popping right out of his socket. So maybe when Miller was reading the original story for inspiration, he came across that, and he was like, I actually did have eyeballs bugging out of their sockets in Mad Max. I should do it again here. That'd be perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's kind of too bad is Twilight Zone has come out on, it's out on Blu-ray, I think. It came out on HD DVD back when that was still coming out. And it's like, okay, fine. Nobody care. You know, they can't have Landis give any commentary because, you know, lawsuits, right? Like, statute of limitations are out on any criminal actions. But, you know, do you trust Landis to be like, no, I intentionally murdered those children just to see if, you know, somebody would file charges. But, like, hearing what Dante and Miller have to say about their segments would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Miller was, you know, similarly an outsider to the whole process.
And I mean,
I don't think he had done He hadn't done an American movie before this.
No, and he had
Working for Spielberg, you know. I mean, this was a big, like you said, big stepping stone in his career.
Yeah, I mean, he did this. He did some Australian stuff, and he did Thunderdome and Witches of Eastwick, and then he was sort of out of the game till Lorenzo's Oil.
Babe.
And then Babe.
Oh, yeah, Lorenzo's
yeah.
Oil, yeah.
And then Happy Feet, and he's just a crazy happy-footed kind of guy, and, you know, he was going to make Justice League of America in full CG or whatever.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's too bad. I mean, and this movie, actually, when we decided to do this, I had forgotten how forgotten this movie has become. As soon as they stopped showing it on cable, people just forgot about it. People have even forgotten about the infamous helicopter incident.
Yeah,
which is now the only way that people remember it, like, if at all.
Yeah, it's kind of the generation not growing up with cable TV playing this is not going to have any idea about it, and Spielberg's gone through. Well, I mean, he's still basically on his post Saving Private Ryan kick, right? Like, so Spielberg's gone through two careers since this, so it's not even interesting from that standpoint for Spielberg fans, and there aren't any John Landis fans that John Landis is not getting any new fans.
No.
I was trying to remember what he did after this, you know, like his event, because it wasn't killing
places.
The kids that hurt his career. It was the lawsuit that hurt his career.
Yeah.
So he was still able to work before they sued him. And then he ended up doing Michael Jackson
places.
Stuff. Not the,
oh,
the,
yeah. Trading Places and Thriller, right?
And yeah, but then he started doing Eddie Murphy stuff. He did Coming to America, he did Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I mean, Coming to America was probably one of his biggest... Well, Trading Places was Eddie Murphy, too, but... Yeah, I mean, it's just like his career didn't hit any sort of skids until the trial. And then, even then, he was able to keep working based on, you know, the fact that Coming to America was a hit.
You know something? It's almost like, I don't know if this is what you meant by the lawsuit was what did his career in, but his career didn't start going south until the trial was over around like 87 or
yeah.
So. Because then he's reduced to doing Beverly Hills Cop 3 a couple of years after that. But in the meantime, he had, you know, the ones we've mentioned and like Spies Like Us and, you know, they're all moderate successes, moderate to big. So, yeah, that's quite interesting. I am looking forward to reading Outrageous Conduct and learning more because it's a fascinating case. And I guess the thing I've learned from doing this episode with you is that accident really is the most interesting thing to come out of Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah, and I mean that's unfortunate.
Much,
it would have been
much as I like Dante's segment. Yeah, it's not even as interesting as I remembered it to be.
Yeah, if they'd done it as like a TV special or something, might have been cool. If they'd done them as short movies that ran before something, but I mean that's kind of the thing is that even though Spielberg had sort of a limitless amount of power at that time. He didn't really do anything interesting with it. I mean, this Twilight Zone, where he says he grew up immediately following this, is when you kick off his, you know, his first rush for an Oscar. When he's as desperate as Bill Murray is for an Oscar, and he's doing what was the first one? Color Purple, he does. Oh, he didn't win an Oscar.
Right.
So then he's got to do Empire of the Sun. Oh, he didn't win an Oscar. And actually, yeah. I guess those are the only two that he really was begging for. And then he sort
what
of.
What about that movie? What about that movie, Always?
Do you really think he thought he was going to get an Oscar with that? I think I haven't seen Always, but isn't it small and sort of not? I mean,
it's more on the Oscar bait side than Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. That's all I mean.
Okay. Well, I haven't seen it, so I'm not.
And I think he only does make two kinds of movies. He makes Indiana Jones movies and he makes genocide movies. So.
Well, no, now we're in the lovely new part of his career where he does.
Oh, before Private Ryan. Yeah.
Which, you know, then he did Amistad, which was Oscar. So, you know, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the thing is, it's not really even that interesting to look at Spielberg's career.
No, it isn't. And this is basically a foot. This is like several chapters in Landis's biography and a footnote in Spielberg's. Well, I don't know about that, but
as a director, it's a footnote. As a producer, yeah. it gets some
it's
more.
It's an important part. Yeah. Sure.
What's kind of funny is I don't know if you've looked up Twilight Zone the movie on Wikipedia or IMDb, but they make exceptions to their formatting for this movie, like. They point out which segment number Spielberg directs in Twilight Zone. They, Wikipedia, George Miller's page, it doesn't give Twilight Zone the movie. It gives, you know, Terror at 20,000 feet, and then you link through to Twilight Zone the movie. So it's like the fans of Spielberg, Miller, Dante, and Landis. Went in and changed all this stuff to sort of play up the respectability quotient of it, which it really doesn't have. And it never had. I mean, that's like the funniest thing is it never had that. It got panned when it came out. You know, Ebert panned the first two and said the second two were great. And then he said some really nasty things about Dante too, which I found.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He was like, who likes The Howling? You know, like, Yeah. But yeah,
well, so. Spielberg, obviously. Well, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, Twilight Zone the movie, a thoroughly depressing experience for the whole family.
Yeah.
And bring your kids. Just don't let Landis look after them. Our next episode is going to be a look at another crafter of fine confections for children and adults alike who reached a turning point creatively and made a really bad decision. We're going to hone in on that decision. We're going to watch Tim Burton's last great movie, Mars Attacks, from 1996, and... From 1997, the beginning of the end, his concession to merely being a stylist for hire, Sleepy Hollow, starring Johnny Depp.
His first, not that it was no, his first not Johnny, his first Johnny Depp.
Not that it, it, not that it was his first Johnny, not that it was his first Johnny Depp collaboration, but it was the beginning of him using Johnny Depp in damn near everything. So, yeah, Mars Attacks and Sleepy Hollow. That'll be fun to talk about.
Yep.
Because Mars Attacks is a pretty... It hasn't gotten its due,
no.
but people who know that it's good, they know that it's really good. For an Alan Smithy podcast, I have been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.